Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, scholar Norman Finkelstein on What Should We Do About Israel's Ongoing Occupation of Palestine? And what do the Palestinians need to do for themselves? I hope you'll stay tuned. Norman Finkelstein is a distinguished political scientist, a scholar of the Middle East. He is an important figure in the academic field of Holocaust studies, an important figure and a radical one. His book, The Holocaust Industry, Reflections on the Exploitation of Jewish Suffering, was published in 2000. That book is highly critical of many established Jewish, Zionist, and pro-Israel organizations, which he accuses of exploiting the Jewish Holocaust for their own purposes. And he has written 10 other books in addition. Regardless of the high esteem in which his academic works are held, and despite very high praise from his students, he has been pretty much blackballed by American universities since he published The Holocaust Industry. In 2011, DePaul University famously denied him tenure. Finkelstein and Tariq Ali had a friendly debate on Palestine at the 2016 Left Forum in New York. We played Tariq Ali's talk a few months back. Today, we'll hear from Finkelstein. Just a few historical reminders for a little necessary background. Since winning the Six-Day War of 1967, Israel has been illegally occupying and illegally settling its own citizens in Palestine. Occupied Palestine has two segments, the small Gaza Strip and the larger West Bank. Technically, Israel is no longer occupying Gaza, but Israel has sealed all of Gaza's borders and imposed a strict blockade upon the area. In the West Bank, Israel remains an occupying power. It is also illegally settling thousands of its citizens in this occupied territory, and it is constructing a series of gigantic fortified walls throughout the area, walling off Palestinians' property from that taken for the Israeli settlers. In the past 8 years, Israel has launched 3 major military assaults upon Gaza. Operation Cast Lead in 2008 to 2009, Operation Pillar of Defense in 2012, and most recently, Operation Protective Edge in July and August 2014. Norman Finkelstein makes reference to all of those historical events. Panel moderator Paul Jay begins with a question about mutual hatred of Palestinian and Israeli children. Here he is, and then Norman Finkelstein.
I was in Beirut in 2012, and I interviewed a young girl. She was about 14, 15 years old, in a Palestinian refugee camp. And I asked her, what would you say to Israeli kids your own age? She said, I'd like to strangle them with my bare hands around their neck. And I said, why? And she said, because I saw on Israeli television when they were bombing Gaza, kids were writing their names on the bombs about to be dropped.
Whoa.
And that mainstream Israeli TV showing this. So this hatred, the anger in these kids for what they've experienced, lived, and witnessed, and seen, does not seem right now to have a way to express itself in a way that's going to be liberating for the Palestinian people. So where are we at in terms of the response of Palestinians now, Tariq?
I want to begin with the question that Paul, or the scenario, or the interview that Paul had in Lebanon with this young woman who wanted to strangle the Israeli children, young Israeli Palestinian child who wanted to strangle the Israeli children. and it conjures up an image of this seething anger and brutality on both sides, and how the conflict has corrupted both sides. It creates a picture which is highly distorted and inaccurate. I find, and I don't say this in any kind of malice, but I don't think there is a rational basis for this Israeli seething anger at Palestinians. If you look at what actually happens during these conflicts, say between Israel and Gaza, the balance sheet is so wildly imbalanced that the notion that both sides suffer or both sides have comparable grievances is simply preposterous. And during Operation Protective Edge, one Israeli house was destroyed. 19,000 Palestinian homes were destroyed. One Israeli child was killed. 550 Palestinian children were killed. 20,000 tons of explosives were dropped on Gaza. At the outside, maybe 40 tons were dropped on Israel from these Gaza fireworks. There was no war. There was some fighting inside Gaza, which unprecedentedly, it cost the lives of 67 Israeli soldiers. That was unusual, mostly because of the effectiveness of the tunnel system they had created. But that aside, you take a place like Shujaya, 90,000 people crammed into this tiny area. Israel dropped more than 100 one-ton bombs. More than 100 one-ton bombs on Shujaya. How can anyone in his or her right mind compare that remotely to what happens in Israel? I'll admit, before I say it, there's an element of hyperbole. I'll admit there's an element of exaggeration. However, it's not so wildly exaggerated to say that I face more danger on the boardwalk of Coney Island on July 4th than 99% of Israelis face during these wars with Gaza. Those are fireworks. They are not rockets. They are not missiles. As a matter of fact, I met a Gazan who told me in Gaza they call them belly dancers because they swivel when they go up into the air. Everybody knows they are a joke. Now, let me now turn to the question of what's possible, what can be done about an appalling situation. There have been two, or I should say, in the history of the Palestinian struggle, there have been basically three strategies that have been tried. One, everybody's familiar with the diplomacy, which begins technically in 1993 with the Oslo Agreement. There's no point in squandering precious time trying to demonstrate to you that it's failed. It manifestly has failed. When the Oslo Agreement was signed, there were about 250,000 illegal Jewish settlers in the occupied Palestinian territories. Now there are about 600,000. If you judge an agreement not by its verbal claims, but by its actual outcomes, Oslo was not a peace process, it was an annexation process. The goal was to annex the most desirable parts of the West Bank, and that process unfolded with a certain kind of methodicalness over the past 20, 25 years. Diplomacy is a dead end. The other strategy practiced right now has been the armed struggle, the armed resistance of Hamas. Now, under international law, Hamas, the Palestinians, nothing in international law debars them from using armed force to end the occupation. That is, let's put it, I won't use the technical language because I'm on tape and then people are going to try to get to me. Nothing under international law debars them from using armed force to end the occupation. For me, that's not an important question. Legally, they have the right. Morally, in my opinion, they have the right. But then there's the political question. The political question is very simple. Does it work? Is it working? Is it a viable strategy? So let's set aside the legal question, where I think Palestinians have the right. The moral question, I think they have the right. But then let's look at the political question. Does it work? Does it have the potential of working? You judge for yourself. Since 2008-09, since Operation Cast Lead, there have been three Israeli operations, really massacres, though the second one wasn't quite in the same level. Operation Cast Lead, Operation Pillar of Defense in November 2012, and then Operation Protective Edge. Each time Hamas went to battle with Israel, each time they set the same goal, always the same, to end the blockade of Gaza. That was the goal. We want to end the blockade of Gaza. Each time, at the end, there was some sort of promise or commitment to ending the blockade. We're now in 2016, 2 years after Protective Edge. Was the blockade lifted? It's not working. The strategy doesn't work. There's a kind of a mutual gain by both sides in pretending that there's such thing as armed resistance. So Hamas says, look, our rockets work. The Israelis are so afraid of them. So they get to say armed resistance is working. Then the Israelis say, they're attacking us with rockets. What do you expect us to do? Or as Mr. Obama likes to say, that they have the right to defend themselves. It was my two daughters. What would I expect, you know? Stupefying narcissist. So both sides have a stake in pretending this thing called armed resistance works. It does not. And then you have to ask yourself, what's left? And there is, in the history of the Palestinian movement, there is the third option, which was remarkably successful. And that was the mass nonviolent resistance of the First Intifada. Most people are much too young to remember, but it was a remarkably successful mass uprising which hurt Israel at two fundamental levels. Number one, disaster for Israel in terms of public relations. Kids with stones, and then Defense Minister Yitzhak Rabin issues an order. It was called a force, might, and beatings. And then the Israeli army went around and systematically broke the bones of Palestinian children. That didn't do great on the news internationally. It was a disaster for Israel, for those who remember. And secondly, it was a disaster for Israel because huge numbers of Israelis had to be called up, reservists, 500,000 at a time, in order to put down the uprising. The nonviolence resistance, in general, as a tactic, it has real possibilities. The question is, now what to do? In my opinion, there is a real possibility now. One of the paradoxes of the Israel-Palestine conflict is objectively, in fact, things have never looked better, aside from the fact that other parts of the Arab world are now getting a huge amount of attention, which never before happened. Syria, Iraq, I don't have to go through it with you. And that steals the camera from the Palestinians. But aside from that development, which I recognize is not trivial, it's never been better. Objectively, a huge amount of public opinion now is ready to put pressure on Israel. An even huger amount of public opinion in Europe is now ready to put pressure on Israel. The challenge in politics, I know Tariq doesn't like him, and I don't care. The challenge in politics is what Gandhi always said is, it's how do you get people to act? How do you get people to act on what they already know is wrong? Politics is not about, as people in my generation used to say, and probably Tariq still says, it's not about trying to raise people's consciousness. Because everybody knows 1,000 things are already wrong. Yeah. The question is how to get them to act on what they already know is wrong. And that was the genius of the Bernie Sanders campaign. He didn't try to raise anybody's consciousness. He just started to say things that everybody's been thinking every minute of every day. I can't pay my loans. I can't find a job. I can't move out of my parents' home. I can't. And all of a sudden, Bernie started to say what people already knew was wrong. That's the challenge. How to get them to act on what they already know is wrong. And there is a real possibility here. The way you get people to act, Gandhi said, is you engage in mass nonviolent resistance. And you may think it doesn't sound like a profound revolutionary text. He says you have to be willing to get your bones broken to evoke people's pity and sympathy. That's how you get people to act. Now, it may not sound so profound, but for those of you who lived during the civil rights movement, what got people to act? When they saw dogs, the dogs on the kids. When they saw the water cannons on the kids, when you saw some volunteers getting killed, when you saw Emmett Till and you saw what happened to his face, that's what gets people to act. People think Gandhi's nonviolence was, about, Ohm and if you... planning to go to San Francisco, make sure to have a flower in your hair. No, that wasn't Gandhi. If you read Gandhi, he says, if you want to be serious, you got to get your bones broken. You got to get your skull cracked. You got to get yourself killed. That's what he said nonviolence is about. If you read him, the real Gandhi, it's almost a kind of cult of death. But it's not like he's worshiping death. He's kind of realistic about what gets people to act. What gets people to move, to go from knowing something is wrong to actually doing something about it. Where are we at now? As I said, there have been major changes in public opinion. And then you have to find the right target. I know Tariq, his innards are probably writhing now, but Gandhi was very shrewd with the Salt March because he picked a target that affected everyone in Indian society, but hurt the poor the most. It was a very clever target. It affected everyone, the salt tax, but of course it hurt the poor the most. What do we have now? There is something. It's the blockade of Gaza. It's a realistic goal. It is a realistic goal, I'll say it 10,000 times, and I am not Pollyannish. It's a realistic goal to end the blockade. Bernie Sanders, he made a point during his major interview, the blockade has to be lifted. That means we have Bernie on our side, and that's not trivial.
Right.
That means a large number of people, more than anyone in his human memory could possibly imagine, more than the anti-war movement. That's a fact. If you have Bernie saying the blockade has to be lifted. 2 days ago, Haaretz newspaper, I was surprised, had ran an editorial, the blockade has to be lifted. It said, all this talk about we need it for security reasons, that's BS. Haaretz said it, of course, didn't say BS. Then the UN inquiry in Gaza, horrible, horrible, horrible. Somehow somebody sneaked in the line. Mary McGowan Davis, she must have been snoozing. Someone sneaked in a line. It said, the blockade of Gaza has to be lifted immediately and unconditionally. It was unbelievable. It didn't say it has to be lifted conditional on no arms being smuggled into Gaza. It didn't say it had to be lifted conditional on Hamas not using the cement to build tunnels. It said immediately and unconditionally. There is a realistic prospect, if we do things right, to at least, in the short term, end the blockade of Gaza. That's what I think the aim should be. June 5th, 2017, the half century of the occupation. It began 50 years ago, June 5th. It means we have 1 year to organize. I think it's a realistic goal, except for one thing. I said, all the objective factors are there. The problem is the subjective factor, because we can't, and frankly, I don't know, I have mixed feelings. We shouldn't want to do it from here. It has to start there. Tariq says that South Africa was liberated because of the Cubans at Cuito Carnaval. How is it pronounced? Cuito Carvalho. I think it was first and foremost, I'm not going to downplay the role the Cubans played, but first and foremost, there was a mass movement in South Africa. In the absence of a mass movement, it's simply not realistic that you can, so to speak, liberate Palestine from the outside. And I don't even think it's very desirable to liberate from the outside, because if you do it from the outside, tomorrow the people will be just as powerless and a band of crooks will take over. Of course, I have mixed feelings because it's a brutal blockade. And getting that lifted anyway, you know, has to be done. So the problem is the people of Gaza. People of Gaza are hopeless. And the leadership, I know Hamas was never given a chance. I know from the day they won those parliamentary elections, the screws started being turned. Then the CIA was organizing the coup in 2007. I know all the details. And I recognize those details. But the fact of the matter is, Hamas now is terrible. It's very repressive, and it's just looking out for itself. It's, you know, in the history of all political movements, you have that mentality where you think that the survival of the struggle is synonymous with the survival of your group. And then you start just defending your group. I'm not going to bring it up here because now Tariq will get angry again, but that's sort of what happened with the Bolsheviks, where they began to think survival of the Bolsheviks was survival of the revolution, and the two were synonymous. The same thing has now happened with Hamas. I talk a lot to the people in Gaza over Skype and things like that, and the level of despair is just, it's very hard to correct. But if we could show them that we're ready to do our all, in my opinion, if we're ready to do our all, if they're ready to do their all, then there's a realistic prospect for ending the blockade of Gaza. And I think it's a worthy goal. The question was, why not, instead of the blockade, focus on the settlements? The answer is a little bit complicated. Not complicated, but you have to think it through. The settlements, there is a strong argument. They are illegal under international law. That's the opinion of the International Court of Justice, all the major human rights organizations, and so forth. So there's a solid phalanx of mainstream public opinion, including, I should also add, the UN Security Council, which has declared the settlements illegal. The main manifestation of the settlements right now, the main manifestation is the wall that Israel has been building in the occupied West Bank. It consumes about 10% of the West Bank, including the critical water resources and some of the best land in the West Bank. The International Court of Justice ruled in July 2004. It said, number one, the wall is illegal. Number two, the wall has to be dismantled. Israel has to dismantle the wall. And number three, if Israel doesn't dismantle the wall, then there's an obligation on the part of the international community to see that the wall is dismantled. That makes it a very tempting target, the wall. The problem is, in the case of the West Bank, between Israel and the Palestinians, there's both the wall and the Palestinian Authority. There is a political wall and there's a physical wall. At this point, I see no evidence in the occupied West Bank of any kind of movement that would have sufficient potential and power to break through both the political wall of the Palestinian Authority and the physical wall that has been created. Though, again, objectively, there's a real possibility there.
Norman Finkelstein on what can be done about Israel-Palestine. No easy, effective solution is in sight, he says. The best bet looks like a focus on ending the blockade and a strategy of nonviolent rebellion by the Palestinian people. Yes, they have the legal and moral right to armed rebellion, Finkelstein argues. The problem is that tactic is not working. Time to try something else. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening to New World Notes. newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Illegitimi non carborundum, and now that the U.S. election results are in, please keep calm and carry on. Cheerio!